shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The Talk of the Town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Bedtime turns me off and I don't mean maybe. 9 to 5 ain't taking me where I'm bound.
Okie dokie. Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us on a three-hour New Year's night, Nocturnal Journal tonight. We've got a lot going on. In the 9 to 10 hour, we're going to have a live performance from Mary Lane, blues singer, with special guest Billy Branch on harmonica. We're going to talk about, Molly, is it Chicago blues dancing?
Mostly blues, yeah. We can talk a little bit about swing and how they're related as well. But, yeah, my friend Sarah's on talking about blues.
So
dancing.
That'll precede Mary Lane. And then we got our friend Nora Barton coming in and her friends from Feed Restaurant in Humboldt Park. Molly McGowan's going to be our sidekick tonight. Thanks for joining us, Molly.
Oh,
you've been on the show
my
before.
Pleasure, yeah.
And our first guest, since it's New Year's Day and it's supposed to bring good fortune, and also since I was at a Black Eyed Peas party before this, we're going to talk about the history of Black Eyed Peas and why Black Eyed Peas are supposed to bring good luck on New Year's Day. So in the studio, we have in order Catherine Lambrecht of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, who brought some Black Eyed Peas.
I sure did.
Thank you.
Recipe from Southern Living.
You've been on the show before. Charlotte Draper. Charlotte.
Hi.
Formerly of
Southern Living Magazine.
And Ebony. Ebony, right. And we also have Donald Battle Pierce, culinary historian, author. So thank you all for joining us. So start off with, why are we talking about Black Eyed Peas on New Year's Day?
Well, Black Eyed Peas.
And this is
Charlotte Draper. Mm-hmm. Black Eyed Peas are traditionally eaten on New Year's Day. They're considered good luck. And for some reason, they have been equated with coins. Coin money, and usually they're paired with greens, which represent folding money.
Right.
So everybody wants to have good luck and lots of money in the new year.
And what are the roots of them? I mean, talk about the migratory path. I mean, I've read all kinds of stuff. I read Thomas Jefferson. I mean, how far do they go back?
Well, actually, black eyed peas originated in Asia, mm-hmm. over in China, and they were brought to this country typically on slave ships when people were brought to the United States. Thomas Jefferson did have black eyed pea plants at his plantation in Virginia, and they have been used to feed livestock. So during the Civil War, they were not destroyed. However, they're a very healthy food, and they really sustained people after the Civil War, when so many people were impoverished, as well as the freed slaves.
And they travel. That sounds great.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Nice to know that they can go from one place to another and survive different climates.
Yes, they're very versatile, and they can be used in hot dishes, cold dishes, soups, stews, salad, and they can even be roasted and served as a snack.
Catherine.
Yes.
What's in the recipe? Talk about the recipe you brought in tonight, and then let's talk about variations on that recipe. There's probably not just one way to do black eyed peas.
Well, this was your basic. Well, let me tell you, going to look for black eyed peas on New Year's Day is not a good idea.
Uh-huh.
They're gone. Uh-huh. And so the only thing I picked up was canned. But I adapted the recipe. It was from Southern Living. It was classic Hoppin' John. And it was bacon that you cooked for a while, and then you added onions, pepper, some celery, some seasonings, and then you poured off some of the liquid and used that to cook the rice and then mix the two together at the very end. So it would have been better 2 hours ago, but what you have is what you have.
Uh-huh. Are there different variations to the recipe?
Yes, okay. There are Donna? Lots and
yeah.
lots. And there are lots that are being developed in there. I think of the the legends about where they came from and why. One of the things that I, as I look for soul food and food that's cultural, it means so much more to to us as a culture, to black people and as a culture, than just something to eat or as a legend or something to read in an old book. For a long time, those definitions or those places weren't cited, or they were just, you know, it was not as important as other historical information. So for me, for instance, Hoppin' John, the name of the dish, I had a Mari Evans, who was a Negro who came from the movement that in the 60s, and she was my teacher in black studies at IU back in the 70s, and she said, that name is not a name that our people would have ever called. And whenever I see it, I think of that. I remember she said, a black waiter hopping along with oversized lips and whatever. We think of black-eyed peas so much more spiritually, and they're so much more important than that. And so, you know, and you can, you'll see, sometimes it's still called that, but you'll see a lot of, and I, in early days, I would be thrilled to find any information I could find, and I would recite that as if that were real history. But I think what's happening right now is a lot of our history about food is being reevaluated and really being well-researched.
Language, I mean, Hoppin' John's became Skippin' Jenny's. I read that.
Yeah,
what happened there? That was leftovers.
The day after the New Year's.
Yeah, the day after the New Year's.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. For all of us here? Are there strong memory pulls to this? Do you remember the first experience you had with this, with a grandmother, with a mother, sitting around the table? What are the memories of black-eyed peas?
Well, I think they are a traditional family recipe that are often served, certainly on New Year's Day. I was chatting with some folks at a new soul food restaurant, and one of the people said, well, they always had the black-eyed peas, but they also had sauerkraut and Polish sausage, which was surprising to me. But as I got into the research, I realized that that wasn't so atypical and very consistent with parts of the Midwest, as well as the Pennsylvania Dutch and Germans in West Virginia and also in Pennsylvania.
And when you take a look at the other kinds of foods that people eat on New Year's Day, like herring or corned beef and cabbage and the pork and cabbage and sauerkraut, these kinds of things, it isn't something that's inexpensive to give away. But you can make a whole lot of Hoppin' John or black-eyed peas and be part of a festive atmosphere and not break the bank.
Molly, I remember, like, you're from Vermont, right?
Yeah.
Was there a black-eyed pea scene up there? What was your first?
No.
That would be a good Ben and Jerry ice cream.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. I know around the holidays we would usually do chocolate bread pudding, but there wasn't any significance to that. We just liked it.
Yeah, yeah.
And my family's from Mobile and
Mobile.
New Orleans.
Yeah.
And we had, I've never had a New Year's Day without black-eyed peas. But my grandmother added gumbo to that as well. Mm. But I think that's just because she wanted our family to always have gumbo, and it's always good luck. But I was in Paris about 10 years ago and scared to death that I wasn't going to be able to find black-eyed peas. And with my son, Monique Wells, who writes about history and black history in Paris and lives in there, brought me some because I had to have a bite.
What are the health benefits to black-eyed peas?
Well, they're certainly a very nutritious food. They are not a complete protein, but once you pair them with rice, you do have a complete protein, an excellent source of fiber, and they are a carbohydrate, which again is a good source of energy. And when you think of feeding people who were enslaved and or impoverished, that's what you wanted, something that was going to give you a lot of energy over a longer period of time. So it was an excellent food source.
Do you know if there's any like relationship between black-eyed peas and other types of bean or legumes?
Well, black-eyed peas actually are a bean, contrary to their name. they are a bean, and they're in the legume family. So they have that legume-bean connection. like so many other beans, they're high in fiber, good source of energy, carbohydrate. And again, when you pair them with rice, that'll give you a complete protein.
I'm just thinking, I spent some time in East Africa, actually, mm-hmm. and pigeon peas were, like, yes. the most nutritious mm-hmm. bean we could get, or legume that we could get there.
I hear it most often described as related to mung beans.
Yes, that goes back to the connection from China. They are related to the mung bean, as Donna said. And they also, black-eyed peas are also considered cow pea or a pigeon pea. So there is that connection in the bean family.
Okay, we got to take a break. I want to come back and talk about the future of this, like with vegan soul food and things like that, where this is going to go, and also other New Year's traditions. We'll talk about that. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say.
Let's just play that for a while. The JBs. We're talking about Black Eyed Peas on Nocturnal Journal with Molly McGowan, our sidekick tonight. And on our panel, we got Catherine Lambrecht of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, Charlotte Draper, I have here formerly of Ebony, but more than that, and Donna Battle Pierce, author, culinary historian. You know, I mean, they're served with ham hocks sometimes.
Yep.
And when I did the book on soul food a few years ago, I mean, there was just this movement just starting with vegan soul food. I think it's really exploding now. Maybe we can touch on that, too. But how do you see this falling into the modernization of soul food and soul food moving away from some of the traditions?
Well, there's always been, vegetarian soul food.
Yeah.
Not vegan necessarily, but there've always been. And it's always been healthier, I think, than it's been given credit for.
Elaborate on that.
The fact that so many vegetables, that meat wasn't a big part of everything. It wasn't like big steaks and big roasts and whatever. If meat was involved, it was oftentimes, for economy, it was often just a small amount of it. And when you talk about the meat in the black-eyed peas, you know, it depends on the region and whatever. And I know that with the ham hocks, the smoked turkey. Mm-hmm. And then I use, my family uses the smoked Spanish chorizo because it's the most similar that you can find outside of the South to the Creole sausage.
I see.
Wow,
I see.
Good.
I see. Yeah, elaborate on that.
Well, I think that certainly soul food traditionally has not included a lot of meat items. The meat just wasn't typically available to so many the African Americans, and people learned to make do with what they had. They learned to flavor, whether it was the black-eyed peas or red beans and rice, whatever bean they were cooking with. They learned to flavor with lots of spices and seasonings, and they learned how to extend the amount that they had. So the fact that it's become very popular for vegans or vegetarians at this time really is not surprising. It's sort of a natural.
In your circles, do you just hear more people talking about black-eyed peas, or it's always been on the radar?
Always.
My friend tonight, she's been having a party for a long time.
Yeah. Right. Always.
Yeah. Always. Yeah. Always on the radar.
But you said there was a run on them tonight to find some.
Well, there's always been a run on them, too.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Can I just say how delicious these were?
Excellent.
Best recipes.
Yeah, we're passing around, like that song said, pass them around. You know, there you had some kick to this. Talk about
what you... Yeah, there's a little bit of cayenne in there.
Uh-huh.
That's only a quarter teaspoon.
Yeah.
That's not very much, but the kick is present.
Did the recipe call for that, or did you
add it? Yes, it did.
Now, we're going to try to get that recipe posted on the podcast so listeners can see it.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Okay? Southern Living would be very happy.
Now, I know a little bit about this, but talk about... You told me about this, Karen. The Black Eyed Peas Appreciation Society in 1937, where you joined for a dollar,
for
penny,
a penny?
Okay, talk about that.
So there was this guy named Elmore Torn, and he was from East Texas. And he came and learned about the Black Eyed Peas and the tradition of of good luck it brings. He called them lucky peas. And, you know, this was in the 1937. We're talking the Depression era still. And they were looking for anything that would add value to agricultural stuff. They started marketing black-eyed peas heavily.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where even Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Kate Smith were talking about eating their lucky black-eyed peas on New Year's Day.
Yeah.
It was a very active campaign, and it really, I would say, probably put black-eyed peas on the map relative to our culture today.
Some of these notes, there were these oil men who went to Vegas, and they had black-eyed peas for breakfast in the morning, and they won over $10,000.
Yeah, that really sold the idea that they were lucky.
I don't know if you want to see this, yeah. So that maybe that kind of started the whole popularization thing?
I would think so.
Uh-huh.
Mass market.
Crossover,
maybe,
right.
Crossover from black culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, but it was probably one of those things that was little known outside of the black culture.
Right.
And that's great, because it...
Well, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, better to be known than not known.
Yeah. Cash had a question. Good question, too. Best way to grow them. Charlotte, you want to take that?
Well, I've not grown any personally, but they are one of the crops that are very beneficial to the soil. They add nitrogen to the soil, and that would be beneficial for other food items that grow in that same plot of land.
Mung beans are pretty easy to sprout, at least, I imagine.
Yeah,
if you get the right soil.
My dad was in Tuskegee and studied the last few years of George Washington Carver. But he was a city kid who went there and fell in love with agriculture. So we always had a giant garden growing up. And he could never grow black peas.
Really?
That was in, where was that, in Mobile?
In Missouri.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Really, in Missouri?
We were first generation Great Migration, my sisters and brother and myself. They moved to Columbia, the center of the state.
Yeah.
And he grew everything else. He grew sweet potatoes, he grew but he never could have a successful crop.
Wow. This might be tough. Three facts about black-eyed peas that people don't know. The whole marketing thing was one thing I didn't know, but what's an obscure fact about them?
They're originally from China and are related to the mung bean.
Yeah.
And so we have two.
Could they also be related to the soybean, too? Because there's soybeans that have that black eye, and there are soybeans that don't.
I didn't see that in any of the stuff I read in the past few days, but that doesn't mean they're not connected somewhere in that bean family.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. What else, Donna?
One of the things I read about how they survived when they were used a lot for animal feed as well, and when Sherman marched through the South and destroyed crops, one of the crops that he didn't destroy were the black-eyed peas. Mm-hmm. And then everybody who was so impoverished, and that's where cross-culturally they became popular, started to realize these are pretty tasty. And so that was a way that they survived all of that, or they passed on.
The cross-cultural thing, we got a break for the news in a minute, but the shared heritage is really important. There's a quote here from Ashana Bailey. It was in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago. She has a restaurant in Savannah. Like, a broader reach through a broader table, you know. So the fact that people are talking about this.
I agree. But I agree that also what's missing is attribution. And also co-opting some of the things. One of the only things one of the reasons I got so involved with soul food was because we didn't have names. We had names that were given to us. We didn't have a lot of history at the time. We didn't have a lot of anything else. But food was one of the things that all black people could share in common. So instead of it being a joke, that always bothers me when it becomes something, a toss-off or whatever, because it's a very significant cultural part for us of joining people together.
When I've done food books, one thing I get a kick out of, and I don't know how much this has been in your research, is just finding the old handwritten recipes. It really, really resonates with me to have someone go through their files or go up in the attic or go in the basement and find the recipes that were handed down. Do you see that with this?
Yes, I do. Except for the fact, too, when people will say the first recipe was printed in this book, you know, people maybe forget that it was illegal for blacks to learn how to read and write. So a lot of times these things were conveyed, but they were not because somebody came up, you know, in her parlor with this idea or cooked it in her kitchen. It was almost always gotten from the African Americans that were...
I think I heard just the other day on the radio that people sometimes put a dime in it. Is that a new phenomenon, or is that a
That's a real old
tradition?
One.
That's
okay.
A very old one.
Okay, we're going to take a break for the news. I'm going to keep you on for a little bit. I want to talk, and then we're going to talk. I want to talk about your own projects. You can plug what you're doing, and then we'll talk a little bit more about soul food and Southern food. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal.
What you gonna do with all that junk inside that trunk?
I'ma get you drunk, get you love drunk off my hump.
What you gonna do with all that ass inside the jeans?
I'ma make you scream, make you scream, make you scream. Cause of my hump, my hump, my hump, my hump.
What?
My hump, my hump, my hump. My lovely lady lumps, check it out.
I met a girl down at the disco. She said, hey, 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 yeah, let's go.
Okay. Hey, Nora Barton, you know, that's the Black Eyed Peas.
Oh, boy, I love that.
So welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. We're talking about Black Eyed Peas with Molly McGowan, our sidekick tonight.
Woo-hoo.
Thanks for joining us, Molly. Catherine Lambrecht of Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance. Charlotte Draper. I'm going to give you another... background thing besides what I've been saying of Ebony Magazine.
Well, I have a blog called Chow Chow and Soul.
Right.
That takes up a fair amount of time. Yeah. So that keeps me busy.
And Donna Battle Pierce.
Right.
Well, let's go around the table. I want to talk about, like I said, soul food and Southern food. But let's find out what you guys are out doing and plug your projects. So, Donna, what have you been up to?
Well, I am, and actually I'm a former assistant food editor at the Tribune, Chicago Tribune, and test kitchen director. And I find what's so beautiful as a journalist is that I combine my cooking and I test recipes, and when I do that, my writing is so much better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently working on a book about Frida DeKnight and Great Migration recipes, and these are people that what happened with Southern food outside of the South. And how they changed, and how some things are more representative of old school traditions because they came here and stayed just the way they were, as opposed to evolving, you know, in the South.
Give me an example of that.
Of one of the ones did.
Yeah,
I remember oxtail. We had a conference when Edna Stewart from Edna's was still alive.
Uh-huh.
And I loved her so much, and what an amazing woman. And at her restaurant, Southern Foodways came up, John T. Edge and different others. And everybody agreed, this is like the historic taste. And it's because she had it from a recipe that had been a family recipe, and in Chicago wasn't as challenged as it was as a chef would change, and as a Savannah chef. That, you know, evolved and changed and kind of she kept it the old way.
Charla?
Well,
I swear you've been on the show before, but you haven't.
Well, I can come back and visit another
time.
As I mentioned, I have a blog, Chow Chow and Soul, and what I try to do with my blog is encourage people to cook with confidence as they're cooking or creating or remaking a family recipe. I want people to feel confident as they're moving forward to create new family memories. And one of the things that I did in preparation for today's show was a very quick qualitative survey on what people ate for New Year's Day. And most people that responded do eat greens of some sort. Primarily collard greens, but people do eat a blend of mustard greens, kale, turnip greens. And I also had about 10% of the respondents ate okra as well as eating sauerkraut, which was surprising. And it was abundantly clear that most of my respondents did eat pork, again, a food that's associated with richness because pork generally is a fatty food.
What about pickled herring?
Well, pickled herring is considered one of the lucky, a lucky food, and that silver color of the herring is equated with silver and wealth or riches, money. So again, that's the connection with the pickled herring. But I didn't have that question in my survey.
I think I do remember being really young, in like third grade-ish, and there was a discussion of these types of traditions, and pickled herring was one that was brought up.
And the sauerkraut and the cabbage, I think of as Baltimore for some reason. I wonder if those respondents came from Baltimore and from that area.
Well, I think some of the connection with the sauerkraut and the Polish sausage is could very well be back in days when people were actually mining. Like, I have a cousin who lived in a mining town, and they had, they were like shotgun houses, and the family next door was Polish. And he said he could speak Polish better than he could speak English up until the time he went to school.
Catherine, what's up with you?
Oh, well, I've been working on a Illinois Bicentennial Project, which finished yesterday because it had to finish yesterday because I needed a copyright for 2018.
Oh, really?
The Bicentennial of Illinois was 2018. I cannot do it 2019. And it's a collection of recipes and histories that we obtained via a family heirloom recipe contest at the Illinois State Fair for the last 10 years. But I was thinking about your comment, Donna, about the about Edna's and the food. One thing that has happened, for instance, the Polish, I'll just give as an example, but the Polish community here in Chicago serves food that is old-timey and largely unknown back in the old country. It's kind of like there's that tradition, though, that immigrant family, these are that food that meant a lot to us.
Right.
And we pass it on to our family, and it becomes part of the family tradition. But then you get the outsider who's coming from Poland, and it's like, gee, I haven't seen that in our place in years. So sometimes we're almost, when you're isolated, like Edna was in a sense from the Southern culture, you know.
Right.
You sometimes hold on to things mm-hmm. that other mm-hmm. people have tried it and now moved on.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention, too, my Skillet Diaries.
Mm-hmm.
Skillet Diaries and Black America Cooks are the two places where, and I have a not-for-profit where I join seniors with kids, and the kids, we talk about journalism and how to do biographies and do those type of things. And the seniors share their recipes and their
stories. Oh, that's
stories.
A great idea.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah.
And how can people find out about that?
Oh, you can do it from Skillet Diaries or Black America Cooks.
And are there websites for that?
I have a link. Yeah, those are the websites.
Okay.
SkilletDiaries.com and BlackAmericaCooks.com.
Well, how long have you been doing the stuff with the kids?
I've been doing that. I did it with the city about 4 years ago. And now I do it in small groups in schools and whatever else. It's one of the ways for me. Even if you make this recipe once a year, to save this recipe and to understand then how important those memories are is very important.
All you guys, I mean, the path that we touched on it earlier, but the I brought Edna Lewis in here, but I'm not going to refer to it yet. What's the place up in Andersonville? They're old disciples of them.
Big Jones.
Big Jones, yeah. Mm-hmm. They use this as a thing. Talk about the migratory past. We touched on that, but that's just essential to our conversation. Elaborate on that.
Right, the people from the South in a lot of ways that came up at different times. My family in the 50s came up from, and it began though at the turn of the century before then, as people would leave often awful conditions to come. My parents were both college graduates, and they left because they wanted their children not to be a part of segregation. And they decided they were leaving all the stuff they had behind to do that. And so what they did, too, is it was hard to find food.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my mother wanted to make gumbo, all she had in Columbia, Missouri at the AMP were the little frozen shrimp. and she didn't have filet. So my grandparents, when they would come to visit us on the train, they would come with giant coolers, you know, of oysters and crab and shrimp, and my parents were thrilled. And they would tell us maybe we would want something else to eat because they wanted to eat all of it. But no, we would all have the big gumbo.
Yeah, right. I mean, it really does take you to
right.
another place.
And that's the great migration. Yeah. So a lot of things changed. There's a cookbook written in 1926 of 13 black women in Montana. And there are places you don't realize that here are people, and that was part of the movement that it went on to California. Eventually, a lot of those families moved on, but there were people all over the country that were there and bringing food that they had grown up with that was important to them.
Isn't that something? In the time we have left, I kind of want to set the table for the next. I'm glad you got that for the next discussion. And it's something that people talk about. I mean, what's the difference between, I've been teasing this throughout the segment, between soul food and Southern food? I mean, and some of our guests coming up are from Feed in Humboldt Park. And, you know, it's Southern food, Chicken Shack stuff. Is there a big difference between soul food and Southern food? Or are they the same thing, just under a different name?
I think that many of the foods that are under the Southern food umbrella, traditionally, so many African Americans were from the South.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that crossover and intertwining of the foods. But when you say soul food, you know, I just feel like that has a lot more of the family connection and emotion tied in with the food and with the meal. Because certainly a meal is really an opportunity to sit down and exchange information and ideas and make connections with your family members or even your ancestors. So that's kind of my interpretation of what soul food is.
What do you think of all these like celebrity chefs and new restaurants that are coming up that are getting like Bib Gourmand types of awards and things that have, you know, come from roots foods or mm-hmm. Southern foods?
Well, as Nana mentioned, I do think it's important that where the food comes from, that there is that attribution as to the history of the food. And certainly when people receive awards and acclamation about the food or their menu, if they're not people of color, they should recognize, well, this originally started with people of color and we adapted it or we've made a few changes, but I do want to give credit to the beginnings where the food came from and where it started. That would really be the thing to do.
Who's doing that well, would you say?
The attribution?
Yeah.
I think Big Jones does a good job here in the city.
Right.
Yeah.
And the food is pretty phenomenal at his restaurant.
Yeah.
Jennifer Booker's coming there at the end of this month, who's a black chef in Atlanta, who's coming there to cook and to talk about that. Do you have a second for one thing about soul food, though?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Carla Hall's new book. And Carla Hall, at the very beginning, kept saying that, no, she didn't really. She was kind of general and whatever. And her recent transformation with the soul food cookbook that she wrote, she said something that Frieda DeKnight said back in the in 1948 when she wrote her book, "By Us, For Us," was her. And Carla said the same thing, and she said, soul food is cooked by black people. That's the difference. It can be anything. It's not a specific dish. It's not necessarily this. But I always say in my presentations, imagine Reba McEntire sings Respect and Aretha Franklin. And to me, that's the difference. That's a difference of soul food.
Yeah, I wouldn't see Paula Deen doing soul food. But no,
that's a whole other subject.
Oh, yeah, I would like to be. But yeah, Big Jones, they do a great job of talking about Edna Lewis up there. He's been on the show, and you know they talk about what.
And he's
influence.
From Southern Indiana.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, when I did the research on my book, I would go around and talk to people about what what is soul? And one of the common, just because I like soul music, and one of the common responses I got was, you know, soul is from the heart, soul is love. And that mm-hmm. that can come through, in, obviously, in the food, right?
True, very
yeah.
true.
Yeah. What else, in the time we have left, which is not much, but any other, what else is happening with soul food restaurants here? I mean, you mentioned Big Jones, and what's
Big
the scene
Jones
like?
Big Jones is not really a soul
yeah,
food
right.
restaurant.
Well, it's Southern food.
Right.
Yeah. What's the scene like here?
Well,
where else would you go? Yeah.
There's a new restaurant in Hyde Park, Virtue Soul Food, and I have not had an opportunity to eat there yet, but I did spend some time at the restaurant about a week ago, and I found the people very warm and hospitable, so I'm looking forward to dining with Virtue next week.
And they're in Hyde Park?
Yes.
Yes.
Is Soul Veg still open on the Far South side? Soul Vegetarian?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing okay.
But a lot of the classic soul food places are gone, aren't they?
Well, I think the ones that traditionally there weren't as many options for eating, you like Isola's and Edna's and
I miss Army and Lou's.
And Army and yeah. Lou's. And what was the one that was in Bronzeville that so many of the celebrities went to when they came to town? They were on Indiana.
I used to keep track in Waukegan. There used to be a number of soul food restaurants. But they would kept coming and going so fast, I kind of gave up on the project.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's
to talk
a pleasure.
About Black Eyed Peas on New Year's night. Thank you, Donna Battle Pierce.
Thank you.
Charlotte Draper.
Thank you, Dave.
Catherine Lambrecht. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Bringing in the food.
You're welcome, and you got my book in
yeah,
that disc.
And come back and talk about that sometime.
So great.
We'll be back with Nora Barton and some music and stuff about feed after this on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN, and we're with our friends from Feed, warming up in the background. And we have our I haven't seen you in a while, Karen Mager.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine.
And talk a little about where Feed is. Feed's in Humboldt Park, and you work there today.
Yeah. It's at the corner of California and Chicago, right next to the Continental.
Yeah. And how long have you been at Feed?
I'm thinking about 8 to 10 years. I can't remember.
And how'd you start there?
A friend of mine, my coworker, worked there on the weekends, and so she asked if I wanted to pick up a brunch shift, so I did, and it's been 10 years later, and I'm still there.
And we were talking, in your own words, describe the cuisine. I've seen it as a sugar shack, a chicken shack.
A chicken shack, yeah. Basically. But, it's Southern American. It's got everything from rotisserie chicken. Everything's homemade from scratch. It's a scratch kitchen. It's got the best collard greens in the city.
Now, why do you say that?
Oh, they're just so tender and meaty, and it's like sometimes you get that big chunk of pork. It's like you won the collard green lottery. So it's a little bit of a, you know, you got the collard greens, you got the pork. We've got some catfish that's dredged in cornmeal, deep fried. That's excellent as well. And then we have our brunch, which we get fried green tomato Benedict, chicken fried steak, pulled pork hash, you name it.
I don't know if you heard the segment before. We were talking about, is there a difference between soul food and Southern food?
I think just a smidge, depending on some of the cuisines. Sometimes we get some people calling in and asking if we have chitlins. We don't have that kind of stuff, but we have everything else from, the fried green tomato Benedicts, the fried green tomatoes, the chicken, the pulled pork, all that good fare.
A lot of good vegetable sides.
Yeah, the succotash.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly the
macaroni and cheese.
Yeah. Cheese grits.
Wait, so you've been there for 10 years. What year did Feed open?
I think it was 2006.
I actually remember that when I moved to Chicago, one of the reasons I moved to Ukrainian Village was because Feed was right there. Which between is, Feed and Star Lounge, it was like, this is heaven.
Which is crazy because back then there was nothing around in that area.
Oh, yeah.
So I think there was the nearest restaurant. It was about a mile away that was, you know.
And I don't think you have a sign in front that says Feed. You have to look for the chicken.
Yeah.
It's a yellow sign with a chicken silhouette, yes.
Yes. That's yeah.
And there's a sign now.
It does say Feed
yeah,
now?
Yeah, you just got to look for the corrugated tin roof that's next to the garden, the big giant garden that used to have chickens next door, but I think the chickens are now gone to a different place.
People, do they confuse that garden with you guys?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. We'd get people asking us, those are chickens, and is that what we're serving for breakfast? And I was like, there's only like 50 chickens out there, and there's 50 people in here. There's no way we can get that many eggs.
Yeah. How's the neighborhood changed? I lived there for a long time.
Oh, yeah. It is. Yeah. It seems like it's changing every 9 months. Back when it first started, you would get some cops in there, just some, you know, people working, you know, that worked local. And now you're going to get young couples with their children that, you know, nobody came in there with kids. Now it's a really kid-friendly place. You get a lot of dudes brunching.
You know all those great chicken pictures?
Chicken pictures.
Chicken motif in the bathroom?
Yeah, we're BYOB, so we get all sorts of, like, you know, 20, 30-year-olds coming in with their booze and just having a nice, relaxed brunch or dinner. And we've had people rolling coolers before.
Really? Really?
Oh, my God.
What's were the original owners? They sold and
moved. Donna and Liz. They're out in Albuquerque now.
And talk about the current owners.
Milton and his wife Liliana. Lovely couple. They originally, they were cooks. They've been cooks. They've been there longer than I have. So I think they've been there 12 years, or Milton has been there 12 years. And when she retired and went out to Albuquerque, she sold it to them.
And now we're going to have some music. Maybe it will have to be after the news, music with Nora. Yes. And you met Nora there.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, Nora and I served brunch together. And again, like the atmosphere at brunch, everybody that works there, we're like a family and we really love each other. So you'll see it sometimes when you're, you know, we've had people mention that, like, we can tell you guys like each other from the busboy, the cooks. We just, you know, every time we come in, we give each other hugs and we're just really supportive. And that's just a nice... It's a good atmosphere. That's just how Feed is. It's warm and homey, and we really love each other, and we just want to give everybody that food that just makes everybody feel loved and, you know, comforted.
And I think brunch is the only time you do table service. Otherwise, you have to go up to the counter and place
Correct.
Your order.
Yeah, and it's cash only, too.
It is cash only.
Yeah, it's cash only. Yeah.
But you've got those cute little, you have a dispensing machine, right?
That kind of went down. there was a piece of equipment that broke on that, and they don't make that anymore.
It's hard to find somebody
to fix it or replace it. Yeah.
Well. Yeah. Okay. Okay. We're going to take a break from the news. We're going to come back with some live music after this on WGN.
Heat up the skillet, throw in the pan, all over the land. Oh, family loves shortening bread. I'm crazy about bread. Two little boys laying in bed, one rolled over and the other one said, my mama made shortening bread, always cooking that bread. Ask your mama, ask your pa, what does it take to tear down your walls? They said, make shortening bread, our baby loves bread. My bedroom's like a bird's nest, made of pictures of you, I must confess, and it always smells like shortening bread, always baking that bread. I was in your yard late last night, wishing I could hold you tight. Instead, I made you some shortening bread, came home and baked bread. Beers to get up the nerve to get a little gift you deserve. I made you some shortening bread, I brought you some bread. Two little boys laying in bed, one rolled over and the other one said, my mama made shortening bread, my mama cooked bread. Heat up the skillet, throw in the pan, smell it all over the land. The whole family loves shortening bread, we're cooking that bread.
There you go. That's Matthew Shelton and Nora Barton, Shortening Bread, live from the Allstate Skyline Studio on WGN. And we're talking about, we were talking about soul food, now we're kind of going to Southern American food. Nora, I've known you forever from Feed. I'd go there like three nights a week, wouldn't I, for that chicken.
Yeah, you did.
For the
right before close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Y'all cleaned up.
I maybe want to put, I want to talk about that song. So, Matthew, maybe can you take mic six, the far end? Because I want to know specifically, and then I want to go into some ideas type stuff. Okay. But how did you guys come up with that arrangement? I mean, there's a song everybody knows about. How'd you go in that direction?
I first heard it by Mississippi John Hurt. And I think I was just picking around on a guitar and sort of accidentally found that melody, and it sounded familiar, so I taught myself a cover of the song. And then when I went back and listened to John Hurt's version, I didn't play it right at all. But it still sounded good, and it felt good. And the first two verses are the original traditional verses, and then the rest I made my own little story.
Yeah, and how do you incorporate the cello into it?
Well, Mark? With Matt's finger-picking style, I try to keep it as simple as possible. Just nice 1-5 chords, a few, not much more than that. And then even the instrumental verse, just nice like whole notes, nice cello layer.
I mean, obviously we all just heard it, but it brings such a evocative dimension to it. It's just,
oh yeah,
yeah, you know, it's really, really.
Someone just texted me that it makes it so classy.
So now, in a concept thing, Nora, talk about all the. You've been on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
How many times? We didn't get kicked out of the studio tonight. I love telling that's my favorite big time radio story. That was New Year's Eve when we got kicked out of the studio.
Was. Yeah, two years ago.
Yeah, but we persevered. But tell the listeners all the different things you're involved in, you and Matthew, and then I want to lead to another question after that.
Okay. The first time we were on, I was on with Billy Howard, a violinist friend of mine, and we did some experimental improvisation, lots of like extended techniques and stuff, and something really different than what you normally have on here, I guess.
Yeah.
Second time was with me and Matt's band, Extraocular.
Yeah.
It's us. Matt plays a Ray Mbira and guitar and some other Zimbabwean Mbiras. Alexis Diasopoulos plays electric guitar. I play cello, and we all use a lot of effects pedals. It makes it real space jammy and stuff. And
the marching band stuff? Talk about other things.
Muka Patsa. I'm in a punk rock marching band called Muka Patsa. We actually played New Year's Eve last night at Lincoln Hall.
How'd that go?
Sold out show. It was a blast.
Was it really?
It was a lot of fun. Currently, our next show is May 3rd, Friday, May 3rd at Martyrs, and we're celebrating International Tuba Day. So, just right. And then I'm also going on tour with Manual Cinema. They're a theater company. They use a lot of shadow puppetry, live actors, graphic artists, combined with live music. Keeps it relatively low-tech, use very simple tools, creates an immersive theatrical setting.
Manual Cinema's great. I was there for a museum. You did like an interactive thing with
the
kids.
History Museum. Yeah, that was amazing.
So gorgeous. All these kids got to like do kind of shadow puppets and see how light works and creates different shapes.
That's great. I'm glad that's what you're here because I have no idea what you're talking about. so what is that?
So I'm going on tour with them.
I mean, what do they do?
It's a theater company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So they combine shadow puppetry and live music. It's really incredible, very
unique.
And dance.
Incredible dancers.
Really. So I'm touring with them with their production of End of TV, which showed at the Chopin Theater over the summer. But I'm going to Boston with that in January. And then they're going to be in New York with Frankenstein, which they just closed up at Court Theater at University of Chicago. And that's a behemoth of a production.
Now, this is going to be a stretch, obviously, but for our food angle on this with Catherine and Karen, I mean, and Nora, you worked at Feed. I mean, the gumbo, just putting all kinds of different ingredients into things. There's no one way to do stuff. Can you talk about how the gumbo and music and all the different things she's involved in, how that relates to food and... Or am I just...
No, there's something there. Yeah. Let's see. well, I'm a classically trained musician. I have 2 degrees in cello performance, and yet I find myself playing everything but classical these days. Obviously, it's very handy to have these chops with me, but I find myself just steering farther and farther away from what I studied. But it's also nice to make a living off this stuff, and that's generally where... it comes in handy. I can actually play this instrument and sound really good and get paid money for it.
So, I mean...
Gumbo,
but
sorry.
Feed, just a blending of styles.
It's got a little bit of everything. Sometimes we'll have some different kinds of specials, and some of the specials are so popular, they go on the menu permanently, like our chilaquiles. and our... we do a black and catfish Benedict. So we're going to get... We do all sorts of kind of fun stuff because it's a scratch kitchen and we make things from scratch. So that's the nice thing about the place. I've been working there for about 10 years and I'm not sick of the food because it's homemade. You can't get sick of homemade food.
I was going to say before the break, I've been going there for a long time and the vibe hasn't changed. Has the menu changed at all?
No.
Yeah?
Not
really?
At all. It's going to be the same boards as when Donna and Liz were there, and same boards now, and we'll just add a few things once in a while, but yeah, it's all the same food.
Because, Matthew, I was going to talk just about how music evolves.
Mm-hmm.
Can menus evolve? I mean...
I guess I'm the opposite of Nora. I came at music pretty ignorant, and I was an artist by trade, if you could call it that. But music was just something to have fun with, and when I was discovering music, I wanted very much to have a punk band and a folk thing and, you know, play free jazz and just and I wasn't aiming for any kind of technical, or there was nobody there to tell me it was terrible, and it often was. But
you're from Cincinnati, is that right?
Yeah. And I
love this guy. This is the second time we've shared a stage, so to speak.
What was the other time?
We did a Taco Tuesday at the Tonic Room.
Yeah.
Matthew Shelton opened for us, and man, I love your voice.
Thanks.
I love your finger picking too. I admire it so much.
Did you live in Cincinnati?
No. I just remember that was the connection, and you went to art school there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mid-90s in Cincinnati, where you could live for $150 a month in a big place with enough room to... And so, yeah, I did a lot of self-indulgent music recording, and there was just a lot of freeness going on among the people there that did want to do it. There wasn't a very large population of people, but some pretty cool things happen when everybody's broke, but they're able to work part-time and... just trying to play every kind of music you can.
And that's how I initially met Matt, was playing on his album back in 2005 or whatever that was.
Yeah.
And what album is that?
Cold Water, Hot Blood is the title of it. It's a guitar songs with chamber arrangements. And
my first time in a studio ever.
Really?
Yep.
There's a lot of good music in Cincinnati.
There is.
And there's Skyline Chili.
Everywhere.
Is that Southern food?
Ooh, no. It's
German.
Macedonian-influenced food.
Yeah. It's a Greek family that invented it, I thought.
Oh, great. Okay.
I mean, it's Kentucky. Oh, Ohio.
Northern Kentucky.
What brought you to Chicago?
Nora, mostly.
Really?
Yeah.
Aw.
We met in Cincinnati, and she was in a band of mine, but then she went away to school, and we weren't a couple back then at all, but she played on that record before I'd ever met her, actually. The producer had a cellist come in, and I wasn't even there. So I heard her on my music before I ever even met her.
I love the story.
And I cried. I did cry. It was the first time anybody had ever produced something of mine. Like, it was just me with a four track for years, and this dude brought in flutes, and it was it's still one of my favorite recordings.
What changed for you musically and artistically, maybe not when you moved to Chicago?
I lost any sense of an audience or well, there's a huge audience here, but suddenly the visual art and things, it's always been a seesaw, and I have a hard time with the idea of taking music too seriously. I've done that, and I don't know, there's not the reward is in itself, and once I get in a position where I have to make money or have to, I try not to pressure myself with music, except for when it's healthy and gets me out of the house playing, but it has slowed down a bit since I've been here, but
do you just mean professionally you don't take it seriously, or there's a lightness to some of the music that you make?
Take the music pretty seriously. I work very hard at it. I don't write as much lately as I used to.
I mean, your voice reminds me so much of John Hartford. I'm sure you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
And a lot of his songs, I think he took his music very seriously, but are lighthearted and funny.
You don't want to
very
be pretentious.
Funny.
Yeah. I take the finger picking and all that seriously as far as the lyrics go. I don't. It's whatever works.
Well, now, Molly, you said you shared you're involved in performance arts here.
I do wacky things all over the place.
And how long you've been on the show before?
I perform. Yeah. I contort my body. I don't know.
And how long you been in Chicago?
10 years.
Okay, so I'm going to go the same direction. I mean, what do you find the performance scene like here for what you do? And you do, like you said, you do a lot of different things. What was the thing you guys were on before?
It was a Taco Tuesday.
And what
it was
is
one
that?
Of the very few. Oh, Tonic Room hosts you can get a bunch of different musicians on stage, and you don't make a lot of money, but it's
a great room.
Yeah, it's a nice venue.
Very supportive place.
And they must serve.
And they do free tacos.
Yeah.
So that's a good, that's a good gig. That's
it
one
is
of
a
the
good
best
gig.
Parts of
you
it.
You get fed and you're kind of guaranteed some audience.
And you get to connect with other people that are doing music that interests you. I mean, the part I like about playing music and doing radio and doing podcasts and doing all these things is every time you network with somebody new, right? Like, that's how I met Matt, and this is, the greatest surprise of the day.
The show's not over yet.
Oh, my gosh. But really, I think that's the thing about Chicago is I'm not that worried about drawing an audience for any of the things that I do, but I like to, have fun with it and meet new people.
But the other part about the Chicago situation is there's a lot of competition for people's time and money and energy. And so you could be doing something that's wonderful that if you went into a smaller environment, you get the large
crowd. It is hard to get people out.
You come in here and you get it's a respectable crowd, but not what you would have gotten in a smaller town environment.
It's very much about who you know. That's true.
Well, I still can't. What were you doing at Taco Tuesday? Were you singing?
Yeah,
dancing?
It's my band Deja Vu-y.
See, I don't know anybody. Who are they? What are they about?
It's just myself and Kendall Bruns, who I think Matt knew from Cincinnati.
Yeah,
you know Kendall?
We were classmates in Cincinnati at the school.
Oh, wow. Small world.
So
we mostly played farmers markets and small gigs like the Tonic Room one, and would pull things together. We write mostly our own music. He writes a lot about national parks.
Oh, really?
I write about heartbreak in a kind of Americana, country waltz style. And we haven't played in a while. We haven't had a gig in a while.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break and we're maybe try to squeeze another song. Okay? So this is great stuff. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. And we are talking about music and food. And Matthew Shelton is in with Nora Barton.
Yay.
It's very good. So, Matthew, we were talking during the break.
Yeah.
Have you ever done any radio work? You want to do the last 90 minutes?
It's actually on my list of things to do this year is to put up a demo or whatever it is that gets that ball rolling. I've been told that for the past 20 years, and 10 years ago I was thinking about it and talking about it, but then I got distracted.
Ernie, our engineer, he just 20 years, he said, it's a great voice.
Thanks. I put up a couple of things on SoundCloud of me reading. I read a Robert Anton Wilson article just because I wanted it to be available as an audiobook and just as a thing to see if I could do it. And people responded well, but I have lots of projects going and it just fell to the wayside. But if I could get paid to just use my God-given whatever this is, that'd be great.
Was there music around the house for you?
Yeah, we all took piano lessons, and I bailed after a year, I think. But my sister has a master's in organ music, so I heard lots and lots of piano, and my dad listened to country music and Bob Dylan and stuff. It was always around.
I like this touch. I think we should do this more often. What's Nora playing?
Oh, yeah.
What's Nora playing there?
I think it's still shaping. Yeah.
Is it kind of an improv thing, or you just...
All
it is All Lang Syne? It's kind of a... Yeah. It's building to All Lang Syne.
It's impressionistic.
So, what... And do you have any dates coming up?
I'm screening some of my video work at the Hideout on January 22nd, and me and Alexis are going to... The other guy from Extraocular, we're going to do some improv... live score some videos that I've been doing. Digital video work has been my main medium for the past 3 years. It was kind of a deliberate U-turn in my life. Like, I just started doing that very suddenly, so I've been teaching myself for the past 3 years. And I've been making music videos for people. It's taken off in interesting ways, and it's like a new life in some ways, but I'm still picking guitar and making my old art, but I'm very scattered in some ways. And if I could just add a voiceover career on top of all that, why not?
I'm just letting it breathe. How do you think? What do you think, Molly? Does this sound good?
Oh, I
this is
would
very
listen
experimental
to that
radio.
Station. Absolutely.
Number 9.
So, last question before we break for the news. What you, Molly, and what you guys do? I mean, I didn't know this thing about the Hideout. Is it how hard is it to cross over with some of this experimental, progressive stuff?
Chicago is real friendly.
Yeah,
I am amazed at the sizes of audiences I see at, you know, pretty avant-garde music. There's a very healthy support for that here. Yeah, I don't know if it's particular to I've never seen quite so many, such an audience for that kind of music. I've never been particularly drawn towards out there improvisation until Nora and Alexis and I started. It just felt very natural, and it actually sounded good, and I was proud of it. Whereas most improv, I didn't feel that way.
Who approached you for the Hideout?
That particular bill is, it's High Concept Labs, so it's an arts organization that I had a sponsorship with, so it's a particular kind of night. It's not your typical Hideout bill, I guess, if there is such a thing, but it's...
Yeah. Okay. All right, we got a break for the news. Thank you so much. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew Shelton. Thanks, Nora Barton. And thanks, Karen Meager, for joining us. And we'll be back with more on Nocturnal Journal after this.
Happy New Year, baby. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year, baby. Happy New Year to you. Well, I made a resolution. I'm gonna keep the whole year through. I'm gonna give up chasing women. whiskey drinking too. Stop my ballyhooing, yes, I'm mistreating you. Happy New Year, baby.
I think that's
New Year to you.
That's Johnny Otis, Johnny Otis Orchestra.
Nice song.
Yeah, right. Very good. So here we are with Molly McGowan, our co-host. How's it going for you, Molly?
Oh, man, this is just so delightful. All of my favorite topics, food, dance, music.
And you brought in Sarah Cherney. Thanks, Sarah.
Hi, thank you
thanks
for having
joining
me.
Us. You're director of Blue Shout.
That's correct.
Now, let me say that when we were talking about this, I this is something I really don't know much about. And when Molly was talking about
it's a shame.
What?
We'll fix that.
My dancing days are long gone. But and this is where I want to pick up the conversation at the beginning. I kind of associate it with the whole swing thing that mm-hmm. happened here, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So how is this different from what everybody knows about the swing thing?
Yeah. So blues dancing is actually a little bit older than swing dancing, but done by kind of the same group of people. So it's one of the many African American vernacular dances that have come up in this country over the past 100 to 125 years. And so instead of, you know, swing dancing being done in big ballrooms like the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem, which is probably the most famous ballroom in the country, blues dances were done in smaller places, like rent parties or juke joints. And they never got that kind of national popularity because they weren't visible to white folks. And so blues dancing has remained kind of a little bit underground, whereas swing dancing got a ton of popularity. And so while when they were in their heyday, you know, early 1900s through the 1950s, the same people were doing blues dancing as swing dancing. Now, the scene is actually a little bit divided, where you have folks more focused on blues and other folks more focused on swing dancing.
How big is the group?
Like, That's really difficult to estimate.
Is there a Chicago group and other branches?
So... So you mentioned Blue Shout. So Blue Shout's an annual event. It happens here in Chicago in the first weekend of April. And we have about 300 to 350 attendees, and they come from actually all over the world. So as far as, for example, Korea and Australia, we had a dancer from Russia last year, which was kind of great. And then
Australia, I remember I hosted somebody from Australia mm-hmm. for Blue Shout.
Yeah. Locally, our monthly dance is called Bluetopia. That happens on the last Saturday of every month. And we generally have about 150 dancers at Bluetopia, as high as 250 when usually the first dance of the year is the largest. So I guess you could use those as a gauge of how large the local scene is. And Chicago is one of the larger blues dancing scenes, but there are scenes throughout the country and world.
Where's this event held, Bluetopia?
Bluetopia is at Forteza Fitness up in Ravenswood. It's a recent location change, but that's where we're going to be for the time being.
And what is it? Do you have, like, recorded music, live mm-hmm. music? Say somebody comes to this for the first time, what do they expect?
Yeah. Sure. So fun. It is so fun. So first off, I like to brag about Bluetopia as a kind of a place for all comers. Anyone can attend. You said your dancing days are long gone, but
that can't be true.
I feel like I can change that.
Yeah.
You know? I can help you with that.
So many people come to these dances, and Sarah or other blues instructors will do a beginner mm-hmm. lesson, and then you get to kind of meet all of the other people who came for this lesson. Mm-hmm. I was blown away by how many people were at this last one mm-hmm. on Saturday.
Yeah, our last event was just this past Saturday, and we had about 50 people, I think, by the end of the lesson. And then we have DJ music most nights of the year, but we have a live band about three times a year. Some of our local favorites, like the Cashbox Kings.
Oh, I know those
with
guys.
With Oscar Wilson. Yeah. We've had Joel Patterson, Jerry Hunt, Maury Sackett in the Special 20s. And one night of the year, we have a soul night. So it's all soul music.
Oh, do you really?
Night. Mm-hmm.
Like what type of soul music?
All of it. Yeah. So from Chicago soul music to kind of the more recent, a little bit of gospel, a little bit of northern soul from the other side of the ocean. So yeah, we try to mix it up.
And what's the age group?
It's all over the place.
Like low to high.
So from like 18 to 65.
There's a lot of college
mostly,
kids, but then there are definitely a lot of people over 40 mm-hmm. in these events.
Yep.
Now, technically, can you, not to get too technical, but like what do you have to remember in swing dancing, and what's the difference technically in blues dancing? Or is there any difference?
There's significant differences.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And it really has to do with the fact that the music is different. So blues dances are very, very tied to the music that they are danced to, which is why there are different blues dances that come from different parts of the country, because the Chicago blues sound is not the same as the blues sound that you would get in the Piedmont region, sure. or even in California or Texas. And so the blues dance dances are actually a group. So blues dancing is a bunch of different dances that are under the same umbrella. So you have Chicago Triple is different from Piedmont Triple is different from Texas Shuffle, which is actually from Oakland, California. Right. And so
all these regional things also hold true in swing dancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can see as like swing dancing, like Charleston is a subset of swing dancing. And so the thing that's, I think, most satisfying about black dances is that they are directly driven by the music that you're hearing. The movement is a reflection of what the sound is. And so the sound of jazz, big band, that swing dancing is done to, asks for a certain type of style of movement, and the sound of blues asks for something else.
Like I said, Sarah can teach you how to blues dance in, I mean, you basically learn everything in the first 20 minutes of your beginner thing. Now, there's obviously more. You can always get better and have more sort of vocabulary and stuff. But Sarah's really good at just breaking it down and saying, here, find the pulse, find the beat. Just dance in the music and make the music happen. And there's a connection that is really important, that you're watching the dancers dance together.
Mm-hmm.
They can give each other some freedom. They have space, but they're dancing together. And that's what's so beautiful to watch, is you can see how connected the dancers are and connecting with the music mm-hmm. as well.
And a special thing about blues dance that's different from swing dancing is the lead-follow relationship is more flexible in blues dance. You have more of a give and take, more of a conversation, and less of the lead is leading and the follow is following. And that, I think, it is inherently very bluesy, right? Because blues is about bringing your story and bringing what you're working with to the table. And so to allow that comfort between the partners is really essential. And it also reflects the European influence, because Africanist dances were not done partnered. And while blues dancing retains a lot of the Africanist principles, like groundedness and asymmetry and polyrhythm, partnering came in from European dances. And so blues dancing is done today, often partnered, but also solo. And people will get out on the floor and dance by themselves.
Wow. You know your stuff.
It's been a little bit. I've been doing this for a little while.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, we touched on this. I try to be transparent on the show and ask honest questions. We touched on this even in the soul food segment. Mm-hmm. I got it when I wrote my book on soul food and civil rights. But how many black people are involved? How many people
yeah.
of color?
Mm-hmm.
And we're three white people talking about
we
this.
We are.
Right now. Yeah. Yeah. So how do you talk about the demographics and mm-hmm. how you reach out to the black community? Is that important to you?
Right. That's an excellent question. And it's especially important to us now. It's something our scene has been grappling with in recent years, as we've kind of, you know, especially like with the Black Lives Matter movement, kind of understanding where we come into this conversation. Most people that come out blues dancing worldwide are white. And we have made an active effort to recognize. So the first thing about, you know, earlier there in the food part, they were talking about, you know, appreciation of where food styles have come from.
Right.
Same thing is happening in the blues dance community. So the first step is appreciation and not appropriation. Respect and intent. And am I doing this dance because I want to experience it and feel its joy and feel, you know, the emotional depth that I can get with a person in 3.5 minutes to a beautiful song? Or am I doing this because I've got this kind of objective idea of what black dance should be or is, and I want to obtain it instead of engage with it?
Oh, that's yeah.
Right. So having that conversation with yourself is the first step, and then having the conversation with the community is the next step. And so at Blue Shout especially, but also with Blutopia, we're trying really hard to even just say the words, this is a black dance. And I always say at the beginning of every lesson, and we played a game in the lesson on last Saturday where we had people be an instrument. You know, it's a fun game to play to kind of engage your body with the music. And I wanted to make sure that I reminded them that the voice is an instrument.
That was great, yeah.
You know, because it's really important that for a long time, blacks only had their bodies to make music with. And so the voice was essential, you know. And so, you know, reminding those little details there. It's difficult to give advice on how to make black folks feel comfortable in a white space as a white-skinned person, right? But it's, in my opinion, it's saying the right words, you know, saying the words, recognizing your own limitations, making sure black folks are asked to dance. I do this also for people who are older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really want Blutopia to be a place where everybody feels safe to come, because that's what blues is about. You know, what do you need to share today?
How does the music make you want to dance?
How does the music literally make you want to dance? Yeah.
Do you do outreach with kids of color? I mean, do they, you know, do you do lessons? Do you show them about the history?
We do a little bit, actually. I've had the privilege of teaching a workshop with the IIT Scholars Group 1 year, and we work with the Chicago High School for the Arts, which is on Augusta in California.
Uh-huh.
We work with them at Blue Shout, and part of our conversation with them is that we teach a Wester's workshop with them. It's really satisfying. Yeah.
There are a couple other things like that in the swing community as well. We had Swing for Kids, where they're going to schools and doing after-school or during-school swing dancing programs. And, yeah, I know Nicole Wood spends a lot of time trying to remind people these have African roots.
Mm-hmm. Is there a division? I mean, is there a division between the swing community and the blues community? I mean, is there one group? Do you guys ever get together, or is the swing thing gone away?
I'm the crossover. No,
there's a few of us that are crossovers.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who do both. Mm-hmm. There was a dance for a while, 50-50, that I really enjoyed because I do a very like niche type of swing. That's my specialty, called Balboa.
What's it called?
Balboa, the Balboa dance, or the dance done in Balboa.
Okay.
And that is, I think Sarah likes actually talking about how that is like the whitest swing dance, just because it was really for like rich kids vacationing in Long Beach and Newport Beach, California. And so the style is very different. It's more sort of upbeat, like standing upright, and again, very close connection. But I love that a lot of the essential, like foundational aspects are the same. The fact that you're connected with your partner. So I get to do really fast stuff in Balboa, which is like a little more like Charleston, and then the slow stuff in blues.
Although blues can certainly be fast as well.
There you go. Right. Okay.
But I think what's important is that what you get from the dance is the same thing. You get a satisfaction of using your body to a rhythm and to experience creating art with your body and with a partner or without a partner. And that where these dances come from, folks did all sorts of types of dance. And so I don't see any reason why, you know, people can't come
use
to all these dances and
other.
Just see what fits for them and what they like the best.
Do you know about the shag in the Carolinas?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
sure do.
Yeah, yeah. That's fascinating.
There are many different shags.
Different shags.
Yeah.
Yep,
I mean, I've been
St.
down,
Louis,
I go down to Myrtle Beach a lot.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I know that that dance is kind of going out of style. They have these things called SOS down there in North Myrtle Beach where they have the elders teaching the kids the dance so that keeps it alive. Are there similar stories to that? Just dance preservation, I guess, you know?
Yeah, that's actually a big deal right now in the current national blues scene. We're trying to learn what we're considering are kind of historical or regional dances, like, for example, I mentioned earlier, Piedmont Triple, Texas Shuffle. And 5 years ago, I didn't know those dances existed. And we have a few gurus in the scene. Damon Stone is a really big name who are traveling around and teaching us all these dances so that they don't die out.
What have both of you? What have you learned? How long have you been doing this, Molly?
I'm only a 4 year. I think.
Really?
I think it's four, maybe five.
She's really gotten really good in 4 years.
Oh boy! Yeah, it's funny that you said that too, because I knew we were going to actually be talking about this today. I started just watching tons of videos, and I was surprised by how similar Black Bottom is to Balboa in a lot of ways. And I'm like wondering about the influence there. I kind of read it places.
Depends on what Black Bottom video you're watching.
Okay, interesting. I was looking at a very early one.
What Black Bottom is that? Yeah, talk about that.
So Black Bottom, it's tough because Black Bottom may be a racist dance.
Oh.
Yeah, so there's a couple of kids who saw a cow in the mud and they were copying the way the cow was moving, and that was that kind of digging the feet into the ground shape. But then there's also Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is an old stage show, and there's comments that the kids were stuck in the mud. So it's actually kind of complicated about where that history actually comes from. So we actually used to teach the Black Bottom, the like line dance, you know, and then I stopped doing it because I wasn't sure what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
But
watching a partnered version of it, actually.
So you see definitely Black dances being appropriated by white folks. So did Balboa get inspired by Charleston, Black Bottom, other animal dances? For sure. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, given that it came up in the mid-century time, I think it's impossible to think that it wasn't influenced by black dances.
We're going to take a break. Then I want to ask both of you again, that's where I was going, kind of like the introduction of this 4 years ago for you, how you found out about it. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Happy New Year! Happy New Year!
So ABBA's not part of your repertoire, right, at Bluetopia? And,
sadly, no.
No, that's their little New Year's song they did. So we were talking, Molly McGowan, 4 years ago, how did you find out about this group?
Okay, so I had a friend who was working the door at Chicago Dance Center for their Wednesday night... once every month on Wednesday, dance.
I remember that.
And I took a class with Nicole Wood and He Who Shall Not Be Named.
Right.
and learned a little bit of Lindy Hop, the basics. So one of the other things that really, I think, differentiates swing from blues in the way that it's taught here is that swing dancing, you usually have to start with your basic step. I don't always like to teach it that way, but usually you learn an 8-count or a 6-count step, and so you focus on your feet first and then the connection and all that stuff later. Anyway, so I learned that, and I come from a dance background, from ballet, tap, modern, stuff like that. So it was nice to kind of go out and try out a new style of dance. I think I'd done a little bit of East Coast in, like, plays, but I never really learned this connection piece. And there was something really inspiring to me about getting rid of this idea that I have to know the exact steps and the choreography in order to dance and be able to improvise and use my body to be more expressive. So I took that Lindy class, and then I came back the next month for a Balboa class and found that, you know, my body was kind of partial to more upright balletic sort of dance styles, and I got really heavy into the Balboa. And partly it really was, again, to break from this mold of, oh, I need to know where to put my arms and how to do all these things, and to just dance and to, like, improvise and find space in this basic step to express my own personality.
Did you know, I mean, you like dancing, you had a dance background. How much did you know about the music? I mean, did the music draw you, or did you learn a lot about the music once you got involved in the dancing?
Oh, that is such a good question, too. I listened almost exclusively to swing and jazz in my teens. I listened to a little bit of alternative rock, I guess, because this was the 90s. And so there was, you know, a resurgence of swing dancing music with...
Cherry Pop and Daddies
and all those ridiculous bands.
So neo swing, not real.
Yeah, that
swing,
neo swing.
Quote, real.
But I would listen to, I basically just binged Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, and I just loved the jazz vocalists and ended up singing jazz in college and just being in love with that style of music. So, yes, that makes the dancing much more relatable for me than it might be people who are not familiar with swing and jazz and blues. My first concert was a B.B. King concert, actually.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Wow.
When you said that, when you like called out B.B. King the other night, I was like, oh, man, I've seen him twice now, and once was when I was 6.
That's adorable.
Wow. So same question for you, Sarah. I mean, your introduction, you really know your stuff.
So I've been swing dancing since I was 18, actually. I think my mom and dad were really glad that when I turned 18, I wanted to go swing dancing and not, like, to the unts clubs, you know?
Where was that at?
I grew up in Florida. And
oh, really?
I first learned to swing dance at summer camp. Like one of those nerd college summer camps. And so I learned because it was the Gap commercial like craze when swing dancing was revived in the late 1990s.
Yeah.
And so I learned at summer camp, and then I turned 18, and then I started going out to Atlantic Dance Hall, which had swing dancing 6 nights a week. I am not kidding. In 1999. and so I got hooked immediately. I loved the joy and exuberance of Lindy Hop. I loved getting to dance with a person. I also have a concert dance background. I did 10 years of ballet, tap, jazz, and all that. And I didn't have a connection to the music. For me, it was the body. It was that I could dance with a human person and have that play, that give and take with that person. And then I went to school for college in St. Louis, and that's where I discovered blues, and that's where I really started to connect with the sound as well as the movement. And so I've been blues dancing maybe 14 years.
What's the scene like in St. Louis?
So the St. Louis scene has kind of come and gone. It's grown, and then it's shrunk, then it's grown again. But the best person in St. Louis is Kim Massey. She's a blues diva, and we used to, this is how you know you're an old dancer. You'd be like, well, I used to dance on crooked concrete outside. And that's true. I did, but now I'm too old to dance on concrete. So Kim Massey is this fantastic vocalist, and she inspired me in a lot of ways. We'd go out every week to sit outside and listen to her and dance on concrete.
What about, in the time we have left, what about musicians? You mentioned you have live musicians once in a while. Do they feed off the energy of the dancers?
Of course.
How does that work?
Of course. Well, sometimes they just tell us that they do. It's not obvious all the time that, you know, that riff you heard really was a reflection of that cool move that you just did. But there are these moments where you really feel like you're in tune with a particular instrument, which is why we have our students play that game sometimes. And then usually at the end of a night, you really have that. Everyone's rushed the stage. The musicians are just wailing on their guitars, their harmonicas, you know, and everybody's screaming. It's just like a real rock concert, just with blues music.
I love the exercise that you did so much with musicality. And it did make me think about how I've heard musicians express that they wish that they felt like the dancers were listening more. I think that may happen a little less in blues, but the fact that these energies feed off of each other is really, it's important, I think, for us as dancers to hear that the musicians respond to us as well as us listening to them. And so that interaction's important.
Before we break, I want you to go around and talk about all the upcoming events you have and websites where people can find you and stuff like that.
Yeah. So Blutopia, again, is Blutopia, ChicagoBlutopia.com, and it's the last Saturday of every month. Starts at 8 p.m. with a lesson at Forteza Fitness in Ravenswood. Blues Shout, so it's blues with an S and then the word shout, all in a row, .com. That happens the first weekend of April, and that's our big blues dance festival with competitions, performances, live music every night, classes during the day. It's exhausting. Yes.
Like lectures, too, historical lectures?
There are lectures at Blues Shout. And then Big City Blues, which is bigcityblues.net, is our teaching collective here in Chicago. It's recently changed ownership, so the website is down right now. But you can join Chicago Blues Dancers on Facebook for information about everything that is happening as well.
Baby, why did you leave me? Why did you leave me by myself? I said, baby, why did you leave me? Why you leave me by myself? Yes, you know I really love you and I don't want nobody else. Have you ever loved someone and you know they didn't love you? Yes, have you ever loved someone and you know they didn't love you? I want you to take my advice. Why tell you what to do? I'm going upstairs. I'm gonna bring down all my clothes. The man did me wrong. I'm going upstairs, yeah. I'm gonna bring down all my clothes. Well, when my so-called friends asked about me, you just tell them I slept out though. Boy, I really love you, and I want you for myself. Boy, I really love you, and I want you for myself. Yes, I love you, and I need you, and I don't want nobody else. Let me hear you, Billy. Yeah. 'cause I can do bad by myself. Boy, you gotta help me. I can do bad by myself. You got to help me, baby, don't I'm find somebody else. Help me.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and that is Mary Lane with special guest Billy Branch. Thanks for joining us. Jim Tullio on guitar, and the other guitarist?
Mike Alcaraz.
Mike, how you doing, Mike?
Very well.
Thanks for coming in. And Mary, you want to come over to the mic? This is your second visit to the show. You've got a new CD out. It is called Traveling Woman. But you guys, tell us about that song first that you just played, Mary. How you doing, Mary?
Fine, and you?
It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Did you miss me?
Almost.
So talk about that track.
I think it's great when you say traveling woman. I did a lot of traveling and everything. Now I'm back in the city, and I don't think I want to travel no more soon. But like I say, I'm going to still be singing the blues and going from this place to the other place, singing with Billy Branch all around Chicago. And I'm going to make him blow his heart out on the CD. And it's going to be great.
Mary, tell the listeners how old you are.
I'm 83.
83 years old.
And still kicking.
You ain't lying.
And this is your second CD.
My second CD.
Second record.
Second? No, I got four.
Oh, I thought this was the second one?
Oh, I got two that's coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh. New one, yeah. Traveling Woman. And only can be Mary Lane.
Right. And that's also the documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And Jim Tullio, a friend of ours.
Great guy.
Thanks for joining us.
Sure, man.
How'd you hook up with Mary, and what was it like to work on this project? Is this out yet?
I don't know if it's
Traveling
officially
Woman.
Out. Is it officially out yet? Yeah.
Yes.
An old friend of mine, a guy named Steve Soltis, who owns a distillery now down in Thornton, Illinois.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it was a few years ago, and they did a community festival in the park in Thornton, and they invited Mary to play. And he called me up, and he said, you know, do you know who Mary Lane is? I said, yeah. And he said, you should really do a record on her, you know. So they brought her up to meet me, and Mary and I hit it off, and we just started making a record.
And how long ago was that?
It was 2.5 years ago.
2.5 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah.
And why did you hit it off? What was the connection? And tell the listeners some of the and Molly and some of the other people you've worked with. You've got a pretty good resume.
So many. I mean, Richie Havens, John Martin, Mavis Staples, Aretha Franklin. I can go on. But Mary, you know, Mary knocked me out because she's the real deal. You know, she is the real thing, and you know, she's not. She doesn't try. She does. And when we were making this record, it was so evident because she would go into the vocal booth and just sing, and what came to her head, and that's how we basically wrote these songs. She would just go in and sing, and we do verse after verse, and then I edit what she would do to make a complete song, you know. But she's so good that she can just go in and do that.
How familiar were you with her? I mean, she had a record in 97.
I knew who she was, but yeah. I wasn't that familiar.
Uh-huh.
But I knew who she was. I had heard her before. Yeah.
Was there any techniques or any tricks you used with other artists, especially female artists, like maybe like Mavis, or was this a completely separate discipline?
Yeah, I mean, every record you do is different. Every artist is different. So there's no sort of formula, you know, or tricks or anything like that.
Yeah. How'd you bring her out?
Pardon me?
How did you bring her out? Or was it? She's pretty outgoing, pretty natural.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mary's real natural. Yeah. That's what I love about her. She's real natural.
And how did you write the songs?
Well, interesting. I mean, I pretty much came up with all the tracks.
Uh-huh.
And then she would come in and just sing. And she'd go into the vocal booth and just sing. And we'd do, you know, 5 to 10 takes. And she'd make things up. And then she'd come in and I would edit. I would go, well, that's a good first verse. This is a good second verse. This is a great chorus. And that's how we made the whole record. There was really only one song called Let Me Into Your Heart where we both had to really sit down and write the song, you know, in a traditional way, because it wasn't a standard blues progression. So that's the only one that we had that situation with.
I see here John Rice played on that.
Yeah.
I know John. Yeah. John's got kind of a country background, too.
John's
he did a lot of session work in Chicago.
John's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Great player. Okay, so, like, Leave That Wine Alone. How did that come up? Was that your idea? Was that Jim's idea? Did you veto ideas? Did
that was my idea.
That was your idea?
Yeah, because I had got tired of him drinking, and I told him to leave the wine alone.
You got tired of who drinking?
Jim?
I don't drink.
Alternate. So how long did it take to get all these together?
It took about a year. Because she would only come up maybe once every couple weeks, and we'd spend the day. So it took some time, and in the meantime, I'd built the tracks, and, you know.
And you said there's a documentary, too. What's the relationship between the documentary and the
Well, they initially
album?
Came in to film Mary. It was a college student. Her name was Jessica Simmons, and she wanted to film, she was doing a piece on West Chicago Blues, West Side Chicago Blues. And so she wanted to film Mary in the studio. She ended up doing a small, you know, 5-minute piece on Mary that we used for a GoFundMe campaign. Mm-hmm. And then as time went on, she dropped the whole West Side Chicago Blues thing and just focused on Mary, did a whole feature on Mary.
It's really good. Yeah. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. They've got some Nocturnal Journal in there.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I wanted to ask you, where'd the footage of Junior Wells, that's in the documentary, the footage of Junior Wells. And you was that down at the Checkerboard? Oh, that was Teresa's.
Yeah.
You guys know anything about the history of that or where that came from?
No, not really. I was there for 3 years.
Yeah,
Billy probably.
Billy, yeah.
But that's the is that the clip that I turned you on to?
Yeah,
yeah. Billy, okay. talk about that.
Yeah, that's that is, if I'm not mistaken, an excerpt from documentary I Am the Blues.
Oh yeah.
Okay. With Willie Dixon and the new blues generation, which highlighted along with myself and the newly founded Sons of Blues band. That was a trip to Berlin, Germany for the new blues generation, and they came back to Chicago, the German filmmakers, and they filmed there's a scene with us with Willie Dixon in Teresa's lounge, and there's that scene with Mary with Junior in Teresa's lounge. So that clip is from 1977 or 78.
Is that in English or in German?
It's in English. But they were they did a documentary on we were presented to the Berlin Jazz Festival as the answer to the question, are there any young black blues players playing? Mm-hmm. And Jim and Amy O'Neill, the founders of Living Blues, mm-hmm. assembled 15 of us, comprising 3 rhythm sections, along with Willie Dixon. And it was a huge success, the new generation of Chicago blues at the Berlin Jazz Festival, which was the first time anything like that had happened on that blues stage. I'm on that jazz stage.
Billy, I mean, there's Coco Taylor, you know, there's been blues singers. What makes Mary different? And Jim, too. What makes her different?
Mary?
Yeah, her style from other female blues singers.
Well, like Jim said, you know, she's the real deal. And I've known Mary with probably, 30, 40 years, and because I was just getting my feet wet back in those days, in those old Teresa days, and you know, there's not a lot of what you would call a lot of the authentic blues singers left, and Mary certainly is one of the best of those. Back in the day, we had there was quite a few women. We had Big Time Sarah, we had Bonnie Lee, we had Coco Taylor, Valerie Wellington, Barbara LaShore, Right, Zora, a whole lot of them. And, you know, which unfortunately, you know, a lot of the folks, they passed on, you know, across the board. But that, I'm telling Mary, I said, this is your year. Because, you know, it's her time. Because she's been out here doing it all these years. And it's time that she does get some due recognition.
Mary, there's, and listen to the record. I mean, and Jim, I mean, there's something so unfiltered and strong about your style, you know? And you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. And it's just so direct. I think that's what gives it its power. Does your experience, when they're talking about Teresa's, what was it like for a female to walk around in that world in the 70s? And
oh, it's great. It just made me feel like singing the blues and being around a lot of blues, I mean, real good blues player like Junior Wells and Buddy Guy. He would sneak in every now and then and be in there with us and everything.
Sammy Longhorn.
All of them. But like I say, Sammy Longhorn, that was really my guy. He I loved him. He'd sit up and go to sleep on the amp. And I'd be saying, he'd wake up and look at me and still be in the same key. And I'd say, you good.
Yeah,
and it was just a great feeling to be in the place again, because when I was down south with Howlin' Wolf and all of them, you know, I sung the blues down there too. But when I came up here and was in Teresa's and everything, all the blues was just right there in one block, you know, and everything, and I just loved it.
You know, Molly, I mean, in the 70s, I would talk to, like, country music artists, I mean, big ones like Tammy Wynette, and would talk about how they would maybe, you know, get taken advantage of, and it was a man's world and stuff. Was it same thing true in the blues here, even in the mid-70s and stuff? I mean, was it hard for you to find your way, or did you have support from the male community?
No, I didn't have no support. I made my own support.
Yeah.
Because, like I say, I got out there, and a lot of times you go around, you know, the females and everything, you know, singing and everything. They come Mary Lane, you know, she coming to take our gigs and everything. But it didn't bother me, because I would get up there and I'd still be me, you know. Hey, I wouldn't try to get up there outdoing nobody else or none of that. I'd just get up there and be me.
You know, Dave, you always ask your musicians how they got started doing music. How did you get started?
Doing the blues?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, my uncle in the Brinkley, Arkansas, had a club called the White Swan Nightclub, and always used to go around when Howlin' Wolf used to come around and play and everything, and he'd tell me, when he come back next week, I'm going to put you up on the stage with him and everything. I said, no, he ain't. Like I say, so one night they put me up on the stage with him, and I started singing and everything, and me and James Cotton, I had a tune, Dust My Broom, and they put me up there after I sung that night. Then they told me, she can beat you singing Dust My Broom and everything. And ever since that one night and everything, every weekend when they come to Brinkley and everything, they would put me up there to sing with Howlin' Wolf.
We got to take a break for a spot. I'm going to come back and continue on your migration up to Chicago. Okay? So you're not going to go anywhere, are you?
No.
Okay. All right. We'll be back after more on Nocturnal.
Yeah. Blow, Billy, blow. I was born in the country, and they brought me to the city. Girls, I was born in the country.
brought me to the city. Well, I'm gonna keep on singing the blues. Girl, ain't that a pity? You got to reap, you got to reap. You got to reap just what you sow. You got to reap just what you sow. I'm gonna keep on singing the blues. I'm gonna sing them more and more. Baby, do like I tell you, and you'll be all right with me. Yes, just be, just do like I tell you. Boy, you'll be all right with me. Well, if you don't do like I tell you, boy, you gon' have to let me be. Come on, Billy. Come on, Billy. That's what I'm talking about. Woo! Yeah.
Mary Lane and Billy Branch on harmonica. Thank you, Mary. And Billy will be curating a performance. And Billy, I don't know if you'll be playing that on 7 p.m. January 14th at Logan Center for the Arts, 915 East 60th Street, 7 p.m. January 14th. Can you dance to that? I saw you were moving around.
Oh, I can't help myself. Yeah. How can you not move to that beat?
So what will happen at Logan Center? How does this work? So you curate it. Do you talk about her career and what we're doing here, and then you play a little bit?
What we're doing, my wife, Rosa, who's right there.
Hi, Rosa.
We are curators of this series. It's a five-part series. And this was what actually led to the development of the Logan Center Blues Festival. Mm-hmm. We presented the Logan Center with an idea that we had, which was actually this idea, was to cultivate a small series of local artists. But in the interim, John Logan, one of the members of the Logan family, it turns out was a huge blues lover, and harmonica player. So he said, well, let's expand this. Let's make this national. So the first years we had Elvin Bishop. We had our band. We produced the Saturday night. It was Friday and Saturday and Sunday, I believe. And then this year they brought in Charlie Musselwhite and Ruthie Foster.
Oh, yeah.
As well as, you know, local acts. And so then we went back to our original proposal, which is what we're doing right now, which is to highlight some of Chicago's top and especially some of the veteran artists in the city. And I'll the first one we kicked off with Jimmy Johnson. You know, Jimmy Johnson just turned 90.
Yeah, right.
But you never know it by his playing or the way he's incredible. He's phenomenal. And so Mary will be our second featured artist. And I do a short interview and do a little acoustic number with the featured artist. And then their band performs for the evening. And it's early and it's family friendly. And part of the inspiration was to acknowledge a presence for the blow in the South Side where it flourished back in the day, and which now is very, very few places that you can hear good blues on the South Side.
Have you seen that, Mary, in your travels? I mean, South and West Side. We just talked about Teresa's gone, Checkerboard gone. Have you seen some of the clubs that you knew evaporating?
It won't be no more clubs like that.
Uh-huh. You play the water. What clubs do you play?
Buddy Guys and, yeah. And the Smoke Daddy. I'll be at Smoke Daddy.
Smoke
on the
Daddy.
19th.
Oh, you will be at Smoke Daddy.
Yeah.
So you go ahead.
I did Buddy's on the 15th, on the 16th, and the 25th of November.
In March 8th. Okay. The documentary points out, you talk in the documentary about you raised seven children, pretty much
eight
on your own. Yep. Talk about that. Yeah. Talk about that, what that was like, the power of that, and also, you know, did you still sing at that same time, or what was it like to
be? I've been singing ever since I was 12 years old. But
so that didn't cut into your career?
No.
Yeah.
I came up in the church, and like I say, after you know, start having kids and everything, I just stopped for a while. And then I started back when I got, I think I was about 17. And then I just really got into singing the blues and everything because at my house in Clarendon, I stayed in a place called Clarendon, Arkansas. And we had a guy named, we call him Uncle L. He used to play a box guitar all the time. And he'd come to my house every Saturday, bring his guitar, and there's a little juke joint right down the street from my house. He would go down there and sit down there and play. And he'd go, come on, go down here with me. We're going to make some change. He carried me down there, and we had a little bucket. He would sit down there beside the thing. I started singing. They started coming up, putting all kind of little quarters and dollars and stuff in there. And that's where it really started from. So he passed away, and after he passed away, then I was old enough to really make up in my mind, you know, that's what I wanted to do, sing some blues. And the hard, out here doing this record that we just did, Traveling Woman.
Traveling Woman.
The hardest tune on there was me, for me to do. And he just kept on saying, you can do it, Mary, you can do it. And I worked on that tune about 6 months, just that one tune. Because the music, I couldn't get the feel, to put the lyrics to it and everything, and I just worked on it. Yeah, you can do it, Mary. So I said, I'm not gonna do it, Jim.
And she did.
And,
then,
and which track was it?
Let Me Into Your Heart.
Okay, all right.
And then I say, I gotta do this tune because this man gonna run me crazy. And I just made my mind as fast in the bedroom door, and I just stayed in there that night, and I came up with it.
And it's great.
Jim, you say in the documentary you think this is Grammy-winning material.
I think
elaborate on that.
Well, I think it's good enough to be,
uh-huh.
And I think she deserves it. So,
yeah.
I mean, isn't that what it is? I mean,
and you got to come to the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, which one? The one with Billy?
Yeah, the one with Billy.
Okay.
Although sometimes I think, unfortunately, I think the Grammy sometimes is more about sales than quality.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know. Yeah.
Sometimes that's the case.
You and you too.
I think we'll be there.
I think we can get there.
I think we'll hold each other accountable.
All right.
But your kids, in the documentary, the kids just talk about how you empowered them. I mean, your spirit and your force and your will, you know, really, really, obviously
yeah,
made an influence on
them. That sings, you know, they're not really into the blues like him, but they sing, you know, they can sing. The three kids they have by Morris Pijo.
Right.
They sing. So, but.
Talk about Morris. Tell the listeners who Morris was.
What he's like.
Yeah, well, first husband. Yeah.
Okay.
He had a musical career.
Yeah.
Our friend Bill Dahl is in the documentary.
Yeah.
With a suit and tie. I was very impressed. He got dressed
yeah.
up.
But Morris, I met Morris when I was in Waukee, and he used to play at a place called Shook's. And I used to go down there on the weekend, and he was playing down there, so I met him down there. And I got it one night and sung with them and everything. So he told me, I like how you sound and everything. You want to work with us and everything. So I just started singing with them. And I came over to Chicago one weekend and I worked with them and everything. Then they would come back to Waukegan every weekend and play. So that's how me and him got together.
And he had his own musical career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Morris Pijo. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Mate. For chess. Made chess records.
Some of that stuff you did, like I Always Want You Near and some of that stuff, I mean, it has a soul twist to it. I mean, it kind of deviates from just straight-ahead blues. There's like a little soul and R&B thing going.
Yeah. And the stuff that me and Jim did, that's all the way from what I do. What I was doing, the blues that I was doing, but like I say, as I did it, you know, I started feeling some of the tunes that I did with him and everything, but I like all of them.
Yeah, yeah. Jim, I mean, Hambone was with us before. Were you around, and this almost gets into the dance thing we were talking about. Were you around during the whole Big Twist phase?
Well, I produced Big Twist.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I did their first two records.
Yeah, tell the listeners and tell what Big Twist and the Mellifoes were. And
well, Big Twist was a... I think Big Twist started his career as the drummer for Hank Ballard.
Did you know Twist, Larry? Did you know him?
Uh-uh.
No, Larry Nolan?
Yeah, Larry Nolan. Yeah.
And I mean, legend has it that he wrote the Twist.
Yeah,
well,
right.
I don't know if that's true,
uh-huh.
But he claims he did. And Hank Ballard gets credit for writing the Twist. But he was Hank's drummer. And back then, the leader of the band took credit for any of the songs that anyone in the band wrote.
Yeah.
So, but that was his big claim to fame. And I met them in the 70s. Late 70s when they moved to Chicago and I started working with them.
They were kind of like a R&B soul thing. They really weren't blues. Yeah.
That's how I originally met the band.
Yeah.
That's how I met the band because Big Twist and the Mellifellows was the band's favorite band.
Oh, I didn't know that story.
Yeah.
Really?
So whenever the band was in town, if Twist was playing, they'd be at the gig.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's how I got to meet Levon and Danko and those guys.
Yeah, yeah. They really were something. Yeah. They were just...
it was a great live band.
Yeah. Pete Special was in that band.
Yeah.
Pete Special and stuff.
Terry Ugolini.
Yeah, yeah. So, Billy, what other projects you got coming up? You've got... it's not out yet, but this is a great idea. And the 50th anniversary tribute to Little Walter. What a great idea.
Yeah, well, I kind of... we went through a thing about the merits of doing this because I was of the mind, you know, there's been so many tributes to Little Walters, but this marked the 50th anniversary, and it's my band doing we cut 14 songs in 2 days, and in addition to that, we have Little Walter's daughter, Marian Diaz, doing commentary. So she's relating some of the songs to the memories of her father.
And when will this be out? You got My Babe on here.
You got My That's Babe. But here's the thing about this. We didn't want to do... I mean, I've never been of the mindset to just copy what anybody... You know, always you got to put your personal stamp on it or you know, distinguish yourself as an artist. So we took liberties. So the My Baby you're going to hear on there is kind of like a Latin flavored My Baby, which was arranged by my piano player Ariel. Ariel used to play with Valerie Wellington back in the day. But so a lot of these arrangements have been rearranged. Some of them we stayed true to the original, but a lot of them we took the liberties and made them kind of our own.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and I'm going to ask you to come back, just play a little bit of harmonica after the break, okay, and then we'll close it out, and we can talk about all these future projects one more time.
Okay.
Okay, so don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN with Mary Lane. Mary, you said in that last song you walked on last night with tears in your eyes.
Yes.
You could, that was New Year's Eve.
I know.
You could come over to my house. I wasn't... I like that. So you had a question, Molly.
Yeah, so you were talking about leaving an imprint, having an imprint on your music, and how you create your own styles. So Sarah here knows lots about blues music here in Chicago, but I am pretty new to it still, and I would love to hear from you all what recommendations you have for some like up-and-comers, like where to go in the city, for people who like dancing like I do. Where should I, like, where should
Billy,
I be, who
Billy's
should I be listening
man,
to?
Billy's your man to ask for that.
Well, we got Kingston Mines, Buddy Guys, Rose's Lounge, Blues on Halsted, Blue Chicago. I mean, this is the blues capital of the planet, seven nights a week. You know, and dancing, the Mines has got where the people dance a lot, but Blues on Hulse is kind of tiny for dancing, but...
Go to Roses.
Roses, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The scene must have changed a lot, though, and the music must have changed in ways, too, yeah?
Well, yeah, because you don't have as many places on the South Side anymore. And it's somewhat diminished. We used to have, you know, a few more blues clubs, but the scene is still active and it's still pretty vibrant. It's still Chicago's still the number one place on the planet to hear blues.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I like those tips.
So the album is Mary Lane, Traveling Woman, on Women on the Blues Records. It comes out March. Is that what we're saying? March 8th. Digitally available now, and there's a Facebook page called Women of the Blues Records. You can visit that page for more information on that. And also,
they liked it.
Doing it right now.
And Billy, you're going to play us out with it. Talk about the Sonny Boy harmonica you're going
to
play.
Well, this is like a throwback. You know, Sonny Boy was the only guy that used to play the big 12-hole marine band. This sounds like it, even though it's a 10-hole.
Okay, as he goes out, Jim, can you introduce all the members of the band again? I want to give everybody credit who all is here tonight. Jim on guitar, Jim Tullio.
Billy Branch on harp, Mary Lynn on vocals, and Michael...
Alfredi on guitar. Okay. All right, so thank you very much, and it's going to be January 14th, Logan Center for the Arts. 915 East 60th Street. Have you been to Logan's? Have you been to Logan's?
No.
So, thanks so much for joining us. And thank you, Molly McGowan, for riding along for these 3 hours. And
thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Jim. And we'll be back Saturday night with more Nocturnal Journal. So here's some Billy Branch for you. La 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 la